From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Wednesday is the Hindu observance of Vasant Panchami. Thursday is the Christian Candlemas, as well as Wiccan pagan Imbolc and Lukanasa. And Friday brings the Shinto Setsubonsai, the beginning of spring. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
You know, my parents were pretty big.
Hi, Tammy Faye.
Hi, Jim Baker.
My dad has pictures with Reagan and George Bush Sr.
How much consideration are you going to give to people like the Reverend Jerry Falwell?
I'm not going to separate myself from the people who elected us and sent us there.
If there's one man who truly understands the political religious right wing from the inside, it's author and activist Frank Schaeffer. Now, key parts of his story are being told in the film Let Me Be Frank, the traitorous turnabout of an evangelical heir apparent, and Frank Schaeffer will be back with us on this week's State of Belief Radio.
I support accountability.
Equal accountability for all schools that receive federal funding.
I support accountability.
Okay, is that a yes or no?
I support accountability.
Do you not want to answer my question?
I support accountability.
Between policy decisions, executive orders, voting propaganda, muzzling federal agencies, and moving forward with cabinet appointments, it's been a busy week for the new administration. We'll focus on the aspects of this blizzard of activity that most directly impact matters of true religious freedom when I'm joined later in the hour by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. But first,
what do you say to a lesbian who's married or a gay man who's married who says, Donald Trump, what's traditional about being married three times?
Well, they have a very good point. But, you know, I've been a very hardworking person. I have a great marriage. I have a great wife now. And my two wives were very good.
But what do you say to a lesbian or a gay man who are married and say...
I really don't say anything. I mean, Jake, I'm for traditional marriage.
If there's one thing we've learned since the November election, it's that things aren't going back to what many of us would consider to be normal anytime soon, if ever. Offering a measured analysis of part of these changes has been Political Research Associates Senior Fellow Frederick Clarkson. Would I like a dispassionate look at the current state of affairs regarding the incoming administration? Yes, I would. And so, Fred Clarkson, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Welton. I hope I can be as dispassionate as you claim.
You write about a, quote, dystrumpian vision for LGBTQ people. Talk about that, if you will.
Well, we don't want to catastrophize things. People are very worried. And on the other hand, we don't want to say, well, you know, we've seen administrations come and go and everything will be okay. So I was asked to take a look at what the incoming administration might mean for LGBTQ people, and it's less what Donald Trump says on Twitter and more what he and his transition team are doing and the views of his appointees. Mm-hmm. One thing I found helpful in understanding these things is, well, where does everybody stand on the First Amendment Defense Act? Mm-hmm. Which is a piece of proposed legislation that Trump has said he will sign if it reaches his desk. Mm-hmm. It has a bit of an Orwellian flavor to it. It sounds like, well, it's all about freedom and liberty. But what it's really about is allowing people to exempt themselves from the law, particularly regarding anything to do with LGBTQ rights and marriage equality, as a reasonable person would understand it. Based on religious exemption, or, and this is my favorite part, a moral conviction to not have to obey certain civil rights and labor laws. And it's we're generally familiar with the idea of like, conscientious objection from military service. And people who believe that war and killing is wrong have to jump through a lot of legal hoops to exempt themselves from military service in times of draft, in times of war. What this act would do would be to allow people like you and me, if we were so inclined, to say, well, I have a moral objection to serving people, you know, who happen to be gay.
Well, we don't know yet how all of these hearings are going to turn out when the votes are taken, but we do know who the nominations are. Is that different from previous administrations and how presidents-elect have named the people they want to work with?
Both yes and no. Every president rewards the people who brought him to power, and generally his appointees reflect his general political outlook. But I think that what we're seeing here, and I think that's like the case of Ben Carson at the Department of Housing and Urban Development and Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education, these are people who've never held elective or governmental office in any capacity whatsoever, being asked to preside over enormous government bureaucracies with lots of detailed federal policies involved. I don't think we've ever seen such radically unqualified people appointed to major posts, regardless of their particular personal philosophies.
So what are the areas of greatest concern for you in watching this process play out?
Well, I think it's the where we began with the principle of the idea that the conservative movement has arrived in Washington and taken unimagined power, power that most of us thought that would never be possible. It can't happen here, as we often talked about, dwelt in the idea that the Christian right is dead or dying or greatly diminished, was a myth that many people held rather dearly to animate their political views. But in fact, it was never true, and the result of that is that we see important Christian right figures and their philosophies coming into the Trump administration. For example, the Ken Blackwell, who was an important Christian right politician from Ohio, who's a senior fellow at the Family Research Council, has been in charge of the domestic policy transition team, and working with Reagan administration figures, Ed Meese, who and K. Cole James. These are federal government veterans who were involved in personnel policy and know where to place people of the right ideological convictions to have the greatest impact. So the idea that folks like this are in charge of the senior appointments in the incoming administration is an extraordinary development.
Fred, do you think our press is up to the task of covering all of this accurately and faithfully? It seems to me that the press, because of Mr. Trump, is maligned more than I've ever seen it before, and yet at the same time is more needed than ever before.
Well, I certainly agree that they're maligned and needed, and I think the question is whether that will forge the kind of reportorial feel that they're going to need to get through this time. The role of the press is about to radically change. That's why outgoing President Obama, his final work, in final press conference, wished the White House press corps luck and talked about their importance, even as he, had clashed with them many times, the previous presidents. And so the answer to the question really here is, like, are they up to it? And boy, that's a fair question. The news media is not what it used to be. We used to have many more outlets, many more reporters, lots more investigative reporting, and the news media itself is something of a ghost of its vigorous past. So whether it can reinvigorate itself to the point to be up to keep up with developments is a fair question, and something that we need to really pose to major media organizations to make sure that they actually do it.
How significant is the religious right's clear sense that they elected the new president? After all, 81% of evangelical voters sided with the Republican candidate.
Well, I think the Christian right is certainly empowered and are feeling their oats. They control the levers of government, and Trump is making good on his promises that if they delivered for him, he would deliver for them. We've never seen anything like that before. But that said, I don't think they're going to rest on their laurels. You never know; they're humans; they might. But they got to where they were by being the best organized force in American politics, and by a political opponent failing to take them seriously enough. And that's been a remarkable strategic advantage. So, yeah, I think that they'll be going for greater power. I think we will see moderate Republicans vanish from elected offices and opposed by Christian right primary challengers. And we're going to see increasing ideological moves wherever they can make them, because there's nothing like having power to get more.
Fred Clarkson is Senior Fellow at Political Research Associates, an insightful and articulate thinker and writer. Fred's the author of the book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, and was the founder of the important website Talk to Action. Fred, always appreciate talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us again today on State of Belief.
Well, thanks for having me, Wilson. Anytime.
The last time author and theologian Frank Schaeffer was with us, he had just published his provocative book titled Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God. Late last year, a film was released with the title Let Me Be Frank, The Traitorous Turnabout of an Evangelical Heir Apparent. And with the political religious right threatening to exercise a whole new level of influence in the new administration, I'm delighted to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Frank, thanks so much for being with us again.
Well, it's my pleasure. And, you know, how time has gone by since we last talked. Who would have imagined that we were going to be talking about Donald Trump and the religious right?
How did the making of this film come about?
Well, you know, I think people think that I made a movie about myself. I did not. A documentary filmmaker approached me saying he would like to make a film about my transition from being a fundamentalist evangelical leader in the 70s and 80s with a father who was an even better known leader to being a progressive person who with very different views today and who writes from that point of view in my books, like the one that you mentioned there, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. So he was just fascinated by this and came and did some filming here at my house for 3 days several years ago, then dipped back into my life a couple of times at various places I was speaking, and then asked me for old videotape footage if I had any, and then transferred it to digital. And one day he showed up and said, okay, we're done. Do you want to take a look at it? And then, of course, it was kind of weird because there I was looking at my life, and I had kind of thought, well, he'll interview me in a couple of things, but I had no way of foreseeing that the movie would go into the depth it does in terms of my own spiritual intellectual journey.
Do you feel that it tells your story in a responsible way?
Yeah, I am very pleased with it. You know, a couple of just personal notes. It was odd for me because a lot of the footage he asked to use, I had never seen since the day I walked out of, say, the Today Studios in the early 80s with an interview on the Today program on NBC, with Jane Pauley interviewing me as a member of the religious right about my objections to why our Christian books weren't getting on the New York Times bestseller list and so forth, the kind of victimology that I talk about now. I was on the other side then. And I got to tell you, it was shocking to see myself in that role. I guess I'd sort of tried to put it behind me. But other than that, yeah, I'm very pleased with the project. I think the only thing that it did not do is really paint a picture of me, and that's not the project's fault, because we're talking about theology. And as a writer, as an artist, my life consists of a lot more than a journey out of the evangelical world. So in the intervening 25 or 30 years, life has moved on and I'm somebody else. On an emotional level that was different, especially in today's political climate, realizing that I played some part in laying the groundwork for the rise of the religious right, the eventual takeover of the Republican Party by religious extremists. You know, we created the religious right. The religious right created things in the Republican Party that led to the burgeoning of talk radio, Fox News, and all the rest of it. You come full circle, the alienation of right-wing religious white American Christians from their government, from their culture, from education, from science, climate denial, all the rest of this begins with us telling people that in the 70s and 80s that the government is evil, that it has allowed abortion, that it's allowed feminism, it's allowing homosexual behavior, that we have an alternative plan. Don't believe what they're saying. Don't believe what the scientists are saying. Don't believe the facts. Believe our special information. And it's only a jump from that till you're at Breitbart News and fake news and all the rest of it, where you are in a fact-free post-fact, post-science period of history. So look, you know, to be honest, looking at this, I really felt like someone who had been complicit at an early stage of my life in something that turned out to be just murderous and awful for my country. I helped open the door to this fool George W. Bush through energizing evangelical voters to vote for one of their own. And now with Trump coming in, you know, with my gay friends and my black friends and my Hispanic friends and the Muslims I've sat down with and talked to in cross-cultural and interfaith dialogue, there is no question that when they're looking at me, they're looking at someone who in his 20s, okay, it's 30, 40 years ago, was responsible for laying the groundwork along with my dad and people like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and all the rest of them for this cataclysm that is now upon us, where we have a charlatan and a fraud who has talked his way into the presidency and bamboozled a lot of evangelicals into thinking that somehow God has led them to vote for this guy, aside from their racism and reaction and homophobia, but just politically speaking. To see myself in that train of events is really heartbreaking, to be honest. And especially as I look at my five grandchildren, just thinking, what the hell did I do back there?
I worked for the ethics agency of the Southern Baptist Convention, and my job was to encourage people in our denomination to vote, to be interested in political things. Then politics and religion were anathema to each other. And I sometimes sit and think about those days, though. I wish I hadn't done that.
Yes. No, I totally get it. And the thing that I think a lot of folks don't understand is that what really happened, individual issues and politics aside, is you had a whole segment of the population who not only suspected facts and logical argument, but turned against it. And so when you think, for instance, how can you deny the climate science that tells us that global warming is not only happening, but they're responsible for it, when everyone except a few fringe people, mostly in the pay of think tanks that work for the oil industry, confirm that, from the Chinese Communist Party to us. It's not anything to do with ideology or Western capitalism or Christianity or anything, or for that matter, atheism or anything else. You know, how can these climate deniers do this? And of course, what I try to point out to people today is that what we helped happen was to get them into a frame of mind where they saw themselves as antagonists of our culture. So that, you know, the same mom who kept her kids back and homeschooled her daughter or son to avoid them being taught evolution finds it very easy to deny climate science. And the same person who denies climate science finds it very easy to believe special conspiratorial facts put forward by the oil industry to protect their interests. And the same person who does that finds it easy to believe that you can recondition gay people, because no matter what the science says, you know, they think they can be healed of the gay. And so what you've got is a group of people who, because, if I may be blunt, they are certainty addicts. They do not want to be challenged. And since science and actual facts not only challenge but utterly destroy their positions, their best defense is simply to create an alternative universe where they hold out, for instance, as Donald Trump does, that anything the media says that's bad about him is just liberal propaganda. And they do the same thing with scientific facts on everything from why people are gay to a woman's right to choose, to feminism, to all these other things. They only discuss them in a circular argument on their own terms. Sadly, I understand this well, because we played into that by telling people, look, no matter what science says, you can trust the Bible more than you can trust anything else. You can trust your theology, your church. You have a group of people who are certainty addicts, very dependent on alternative information, which is not fact-based. And so Trump comes along, and it's basically like a guy who's pushing drugs on a block that have never been pushed before, but addicts are already in a frame of mind of receiving this kind of drug, the special information, I'll solve your problems, don't listen to the media. You know, when you're wondering why 81% of white evangelicals voted for this guy, it's very simple. They've been trained like Pavlov's dogs to respond to alternative information and claims that everything you're getting mainstream, say from MIT, Harvard, the New York Times, whatever it might be, is bogus, de facto bogus, no matter what, because your whole worldview is in opposition to a fact-based reality. And I just can't say it enough. I mean, that's the deal.
Well, Frank, we know that many what I call otherwise reasonable Americans who seem intent on underestimating this force in our culture, even believing that the religious right is dead when evidence to the contrary is impossible to overlook. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one of my thoughts is that people like the New York Times and the mainstream media didn't do their job. I mean, I'll just point it out to you like this. 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump. Whether Putin twisted the election or not, whatever else the facts were, that Hillary was a bad candidate, none of that counts compared to that 81% of white evangelicals. If you remove that voting block, or you split it, or you even peel off 10% of it, he's not president. And so, you know, people talk about, well, 28% of Hispanics voted for him, and how do you explain that? And 52% of women voted for him, how do you explain that? 81% of white evangelicals voted for this man. So they are important. They've given us basically the biggest thing to happen in our history since Pearl Harbor in terms of just changing the dynamic of everything overnight. Okay, now look at somebody like the New York Times. They have a style section. They have a science section. They have a culture section. They have an art section. They have a food section. They have all kinds of sections. There's detailed coverage every week of society weddings and so forth. Where's the religion section? It hasn't been there. Religion has always been treated as like something that, you know, people do privately. It has nothing to do with us. We pretend as if we're in the age of reason and we've moved on from this. We are not. We are in the age of ascendant fundamentalist religion globally. It isn't just the U.S. It's Vladimir Putin's hand-in-glove symbiotic relationship with the hard line of the Russian Orthodox Church and their nationalist czarist aspirations. It is exactly what has happened in all the Arab countries where you have a civil war between moderate Muslims and intolerant Muslims. It's what's happening now in even France, that all of a sudden is in the light of resurgent nationalism and anti-European Union sentiment, suddenly finding roots in a very conservative view of Roman Catholicism, and you have a whole group doing that. When you look at what's going on in India, it isn't just the Christian world or the communist world. You have an insurgency now represented by the Prime Minister of India of a Hindu nationalism that's trying to chase Christians out and, of course, always had problems with Muslims before. Essentially, what you have is, you know, there's the Enlightenment and there's the Renaissance, and it plays out through history, and you have science, and all the way along, fundamentalist religion per se is unhappy with this. The fact of the matter is, though, we are now at a breaking point where what you might call a reasonable science-based view of life is on a collision course, a fatal collision course globally with resurgent fundamentalism. So whether it is the 81% of white evangelicals who voted for Trump or some little group of ISIS trying to create a caliphate, the reaction to what they regard as godless secularism is the same. And so that's where we're at. And we're just simply looking at our version of it here. Except ours is complicated because we have not only a history with this Christian fundamentalism going back all the way into the slave-owning people, but we've got a current problem where you have a con man who has nothing to do with religion per se himself, who has manipulated these people masterfully by playing on their worst instincts and fears. And so it's even worse in terms of what's happened in the U.S. with Trump's election.
Frank Schaeffer is a best-selling author, an educator, and a theologian whose family roots are deep in activist evangelical Christianity. Frank's story is told in the documentary film Let Me Be Frank, the Traitorous Turnabout of an Evangelical Heir Apparent. Information is available at letmebefrankmovie.com. Frank, it's always great to talk with you, and despite all the changes facing our nation, it's heartening to know that you continue to be out there thinking and writing and painting and speaking. Thanks for making time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me on. A real pleasure. Thank you.
It's been a whirlwind of activity for the new administration in the first week since the inauguration. For a look at how things have been going and whether there are reasons for concern regarding matters of true religious freedom, I am happy to be joined once again by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to see you in this new world order, Welton.
You know, personally, how are you navigating what to focus on in this first week of the new administration as you think about Interfaith Alliance?
That's such a hard question, I have to tell you. I think I've mentioned to you before, a lot of the issues that you and I partnered on 15, 18, 20 years ago that we thought were pretty much resolved now seem to be wide open again. And Interfaith Alliance, as it has participated in some of the successes as we've progressed through these past few administrations, some of the things that we focused on that we thought were behind us are now in front of us again. There are the questions about the Attorney General designate's civil rights and religious freedom record. There are concerns about the Secretary of Education designate's approach to public schools and to vouchers, and especially to the place of religious life in education. There are concerns about the Affordable Care Act and what it will include and exclude and for how long and all sorts of stuff like that. And then literally, Welton, as we were connecting for this interview, there was the news that the president has signed an executive order that restores the ability of the CIA to use methods of interrogation that were designated as torture and declared illegal under the last administration. So I don't know where to start, to be honest with you. I'll be at a press conference today about the new immigration policy, which is clearly targeted at the Muslim community. Very, very distressing times.
Jack, I'm going to make a confession to you that I usually wouldn't make on the air, but I'm going to do so because I have a sense that what I'm feeling is what a lot of our listeners are feeling also. I'm scared. It struck me as I'm in a different world. This isn't the nation that I think I'm a citizen of. And I'm scared and don't know how to confront that or how you and other people who are leaders in Washington are going to confront it.
Let me suggest a couple of things to you. First of all, on a purely human level, you and I, and I imagine most of our listeners, now have a sudden dose of empathy for the people who put Mr. Trump into office. This is how they've been feeling for a long time. And my own sins I have to acknowledge today. I paid very little attention to them. I thought they were part of the past. I thought that the values that they held were values that were atrophying. And their concerns about putting America first, as the president has become fond of saying, were not part of the new sense of living in a global community. But the fact of the matter is that they had fears just like we're feeling right now. Mm-hmm. And someone offered them an alternative to the way things were going, and they reached for it. I can't fault them for acting out of their concern that the world would not be the place that they recognize. But that has to be instructive to folks like you and me. We have to understand that if we want the world to be the kind of place that we think it ought to be, we have to work for it. We have to encourage the people who will be our leaders. We have to get out the vote. We have to be effective in carrying our message. So number one is use this as an opportunity to feel empathy for all of us who are part of this beloved community. The other thing is, I think you ought to stay afraid. I think being afraid is an important thing right now. I think that we need to be careful not to allow our fear to govern our politics. That is, after all, what we are reacting to now. But we can't afford to be complacent. We can't afford to allow the kinds of actions we're seeing happen at a federal level to become normative. And we can't allow the kinds of behaviors that are distracting us from the important issues to become what's expected. To be honest with you, I don't care what Mr. Trump did or did not do in a hotel room in Russia, however many years ago. I care about an immigration policy. I care about health care. I care about the rights of people to love and marry whom they choose. And I refuse to be distracted by the things that are just taking me away from what's important in this world. So we should watch these policies, and we should be afraid, and we should act in respectful opposition. If you look at the lineup of people who spoke in the name of religious communities at the president's inauguration, you saw the people that he invited to be a part of that very public ceremony. The presence of Franklin Graham as a spokesman for God was very distressing. Here's a man who has attempted to denigrate people who don't believe the way that he does. And the other signal that people should have seen was the choice of Robert Jeffress, the pastor of First Baptist in Dallas, to deliver the sermon at the pre-inaugural prayer service for the first and second families and their guests. Now, I spoke at that service 4 years ago, and I can tell you that there was a message of celebration and inclusiveness and openness that was present in the words of the very diverse group of people who were part of that service. Pastor Jeffress chose a ridiculous analogy about a wall, which is probably the most clear understanding that there are going to be some people on the inside and some people on the outside. And given his own record of declaring that not only Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs and Buddhists are going to hell, but so are Christians who don't believe the way that he does, I think we are gearing up for the kinds of uncivil holy wars that Interfaith Alliance has long struggled to diffuse so that people can talk to each other across whatever faith divide that there is. And if you are someone, if you love someone who is a lesbian, gay, or transgender, I think you got to watch very carefully. If you are a member of a religious minority or a friend of someone in a religious minority, I think you have to be prepared that there are going to be challenges to the free expression of your religious life. The most important thing we have to watch for is the protection of the Johnson Amendment, so that pastors and other religious leaders are not able to endorse candidates from their pulpits, so that 501c3 organizations, which are tax exempt, are not able to involve themselves in the political process in campaigns, because if that happens, it's going to make the Citizens United decision in the Supreme Court look like an attractive alternative.
Yeah. Interfaith Alliance has an important event coming up in just a couple of months, and I'd like for you to talk about that.
We were fortunate to enjoy the sponsorship and the endorsement of Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America, in the years between his retirement from CBS News and his death. He was our spokesman and probably our biggest booster. And in appreciation, we named awards for him, the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards. And they've been given to some extraordinary people in and out of journalism, in and out of public life over the course of the years. This spring, those awards will be renewed, and we have two extraordinary individuals who were scheduled to receive these awards before the election. One is the extraordinary Diane Rehm, who for many, many years was the morning voice of NPR. The Diane Rehm Show was a place where people could hear honest conversation from all sorts of perspectives, And Diane herself is just a warm and wonderful person. She's the best friend of everybody because she is a true listener. So she'll be receiving one of those awards. And the other award we will be presenting to Khizr Khan. And our listeners are familiar with him from his extraordinary presentation at the Democratic National Convention, from his devotion as a Gold Star parent, from his interview with you just a couple of months ago on State of Belief. And he will be receiving an award from us as well for his role in elevating the American experience. That's all going to happen on April 4th. We are so happy to have the sponsorship for this event here in Washington, D.C., from our dear friend Mitchell Gold of Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, and from his own nonprofit Faith in America, which is defending the rights of LGBTQ individuals. And that's going to be at his store in Washington, D.C. It's going to be a wonderful stand-up reception surrounded by fabulous furniture and wonderful people.
Jack, we, as you said, have spoken with Mr. Khan on this show not long ago, and we'll have Diane Rehm with us soon. In the meantime, how can listeners get more information about the event as well as about supporting the work of Interfaith Alliance in general?
The event and our work in general can be explored at www.interfaithalliance.org. It's our newish website. It hasn't been up for 3 months, and it has all the information you need about what we're doing at the moment and about the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards in April. So I encourage everybody to go there, to hit the donate button 3 or 4 times. But I'm going to ask our listeners to do two other things on a regular basis. One is to make an appointment with yourself at least once a week to call your member of Congress, to call one or both of your senators, to express your concerns about what's going on in government today. Don't allow these opportunities to pass. You're not going to get to talk directly to your representatives, but your call makes a difference because they want to hear from their constituency and they want to get reelected. So they want to know what's on your mind. And the other thing I'm going to ask you to do is to express your appreciation to people who serve our country. I know you usually think of that in terms of military service, and I would encourage you to do that as well. But I've talked to a lot of civil servants over the course of the past couple of months. Just yesterday, I gave an address to Immigration and Customs Enforcement in commemoration of their acknowledgement of Dr. King's birthday. And I was struck by the diversity of the people in that room, the dedication that they have in a very difficult area of government. Public servants have come under a certain amount of attack from the administration, and yet their service to this country keeps our government operating and keeps our life free and secure. So if you know somebody who works for the government, someone who's a civil servant, please express your appreciation to them and tell them that they have your support just as much as the people who carry arms on behalf of the United States.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, Protecting True Religious Freedom. It's a time when the alliance is particularly important because its work happens at the intersection of public policy and our culture and our society. Jack, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Altman. Stay in shape because as my predecessor, I stand on the shoulders of a giant, and keep that back in shape.
Thanks, man. Before we go, after the first week, I want to share with you the first installment of my take on how President Donald Trump's Making America Great Again went. During the first week of this new administration, I saw both the worst of America and the best of America. How to abort democracy and how to preserve democracy. Let me briefly parse both developments. Conservative columnist George Will spoke for most people when he branded President Trump's inaugural speech as, quote, the most dreadful ever, end quote. I watched closely and listened carefully to every word the incoming president spoke. It struck me that he was still campaigning. You know, it's almost as if he's trying to convince himself that he needs to be in the Oval Office. It bothered me greatly that the president was unable to affirm the history of this nation. Obviously, he had learned nothing from Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Obama. Missing entirely from his few words of the inaugural address were a recommitment to historic American values, gratitude for any leader that had preceded him, encouragement in an attempt to heal divisions and begin to unite a badly divided nation. No, no, no. He labeled what had preceded him as American carnage. Evidently, he considers the work of previous presidents, several of whom were there to hear him, a failure. Trump seemed to think that the goodness and value of America would begin with him. The people the new president chose to have around him for the inaugural spoke volumes about this man's values. You've heard that already on today's show. Take Franklin Graham, for example, a so-called evangelist who, prior to blessing Trump as God's choice for the presidency, had repeatedly called all Muslims evil, and more than once, speaking to hurting Americans, declared that the nation will not be all right until all who inhabit it confess Jesus as their Savior. It was saddening as well as ironic that in the most religiously pluralistic nation in the world, the inauguration of our new leader was more Christian than it was inclusive or democratic. In the inaugural address, the president was true to his ever-changing promises and incredibly disturbing contradictory statements, as well as words that weakened trust in and respect for him. Unfortunately, even the best of his statements, which were few, did not comport with the hateful language that got him into this moment and the threatened discrimination that left citizens divided and hurting. The decisions, executive orders, attacks against the press, suggestions of movement toward actions that qualify as war crimes, efforts to stop assurances of voting rights, removal of our nation's help for women who have been raped, and threats that evoked fear in our longtime friends abroad make it difficult for me to see anything great in the president's initiative branded as rebuilding our country. The new president promised that, quote, we will be protected by God. Perhaps he assumes that he also can control God like he wants to control all of us. I watched the moving prayer service that the president attended at the National Cathedral on Saturday morning. It was a time of meditation and words that embodied the kind of radical inclusion that best represents religions in our nation and our nation itself. As I watched and listened to spokespersons representative of a wide diversity of religions affirm justice and love, inclusion and mercy, simultaneously at the bottom of my television screen, I followed a news crawl reporting on the unjust decisions already made by the president who came for prayers, the president who promised that he would focus singularly on our nation as if we're no longer a part of the global community. Toward the end of his inaugural speech, President Trump declared, "Now arrives the hour of action." Little did he know how quickly that statement would come to fruition. Not in the gold-laced office of the president, where he would later sit, but in the streets of the world, where millions of people came together to register opposition to the election of this man whom our Electoral College chose for the president of the United States. What we saw on that Saturday was the best of democracy. Peaceful, even joyful individuals of all ages and of different sexual orientations march. Marching to say that we will not allow this president to turn us from America's greatness to a new level of self-centered isolationism and efforts to restrict freedoms to only a few of one ideology. There was hope there. There was vision. There was energy. There were people who knew how to come together regardless of their vote in the national election. Had it not been for the protests on that Saturday and the hope born of the words, faces, and actions of those people in the streets of the world, I would have ended the week angry and depressed. From the new president's words and actions came absolutely nothing that engendered praise or hope in me. But in the people of the streets, I saw the resilience, the promise, and the hope of people who love justice, practice mercy, and walk with vision. All week long, maybe it all started with me watching Lawrence O'Donnell and hearing this music on his show. After last Saturday, I have found myself humming and sometimes singing quietly to myself the words of Buffalo Springfield. There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. That's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds, 1,000 people in the streets singing songs and carrying signs. I think it's time to stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down?
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down?
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on your support to be able to continue this important work as we have since the launch of this show 11 years ago this month. We're counting on you now more than ever, and quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.